Starwalker Studios presents GM Intrusions, the podcast devoted to Numenera and the Strange.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 20 of GM Intrusions, the podcast devoted to Numenera and the Strange. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. Wow, 20 episodes. Can you believe it's been 20 episodes? I can't. Mind-blowing. Anyway, Jim Ryan joins me on the show today to discuss his adventure Towers of Glass and running Numenera at a convention, among other things. So grab your dice and get ready to spend some effort. It's time for a GM Intrusion. GM Intrusions Roundtable. Jim Ryan is joining us on the show today, and you might find his voice very familiar as he's one of the hosts of the Transmissions from the Ninth World podcast. So welcome to the show, Jim.
Hello. Greetings to you, sir.
So maybe you could start out telling us about being a host of Transmissions from the Ninth World and how that came to be.
It was very strange, actually. Okay. It's kind of tied into my interest in Numenera as well, really, but kind of, but it'd be hard to really separate the two at this point, in a way. But I had heard about Numenera during the Kickstarter, and a couple of the friends that I play tabletop games with, David and Eric, came to me at one point and said, "We're really excited about the concept of Numenera, this Kickstarter. I don't know if you've seen it." And I was like, "Oh yeah, yeah, I've seen that. I looked at that." And they said, "Yes, we want to start a podcast, and we'd like to get in, and we'd like to get you in on it because we know that you've done podcasting before." And I was like, "Okay." I've got my hands full with the podcast I'm doing right now, but if you just want me on in like an advisory capacity, I'll be happy to come and help out and do what I can. And I like the concept of Numenera too, so yeah, sure, why not? And so. Yeah, basically we sat down and we talked about how podcasting is done and all that, and then they started it up. And I really enjoy being on Transmissions from the Ninth World because that's pretty much the one show where I have to do very little in the way of work.
Oh, nice.
I just sit back and I act silly, and that's pretty much my entire role on the show.
I need a show like that. That sounds great.
It's awesome. If you can get a co-hosting gig somewhere, I'd say do it because it's the laid back version of the thing that one does normally.
Well, I have to say this is a little surreal for me because I've listened to that podcast since I first found out about Numenera, and so I almost feel like I know you. I've listened to that podcast so much.
Ah, then for that I apologize.
Yeah, but you guys did a great job in that dark time before the game actually came out when we were all just, you know, so excited to play it, and you guys had so many great interviews with people from Monte Cook Games, and it made the wait more tolerable, that's for sure.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, we're very proud of it. We basically, to be honest, I think the timing had a lot to do with it. Our ability to be able to get folks on and talk about it. And I mean, David really, I think, is the main sort of driving core of that show. He really very badly wanted Numenera to succeed and succeed as well as it possibly could because he loved the concept. Eric also really liked the concept, and he's more the technical brain on that show. They really wanted it to go forth and do it, and they went out and they did it, and I was just very pleased to be able to be along for the ride.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys had any kind of inside information, but I'm really impressed because I've actually gone back and listened to some of the episodes again since the game has come out, and I'm really impressed how well you guys did talking about the system and everything before we even really knew for sure what the system was. You guys did a great job kind of forecasting how it was going to work.
Oh, yeah. Most of what we had was just right from Monty Cook's blog.
Yeah.
So it was it was all stuff that was publicly available for the most part. Once we actually were contacted by Monty Cook Games and started getting some of them on the show, I think we were able to get some information a little bit ahead of time.
Okay.
But it was really pretty much it was, I think, mostly a thing where they decided to a certain point at which they wanted to make announcements. And if we were available at the time, they'd do it on our show. And yeah. Of course, that was, of course, very cool for us. We loved that. But it was just, I think it's a big sort of timing type thing there, a bit of serendipity that worked out pretty well for us. And anyone who's doing a Kickstarter is going to want to try to promote what they can as much as they can of it. And so I think we were just lucky to be able to get in and be able to essentially help each other in that regard.
Yeah, totally. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your history with RPGs leading up to Numenera.
Ah, yes. Well, way back in the dark and misty early 14th century when I was a young lad, and they started talking about this idea of role-playing. No. I think my history with RPGs goes back to when I was a kid. My mother actually got me the Endless Quest books, which were D&D versions of the Choose Your Own Adventure books.
Oh, cool.
She was very much into fantasy herself and was kind of interested in role-playing. She was a performer in Renaissance fairs.
Oh, and, wow.
By association, therefore, I was also a performer in Renaissance fairs in that she would use me in her act. And so she knew a lot of the same kinds of folks who were interested in D&D and things of that nature. So I really got introduced to the concepts of those through her and through people she knew. And I was also familiar with the concept of playing roles in general, since I'd been acting since like the age of 4. So there was that. There were the computer role-playing games that I would play. Well, they weren't exactly role-playing games back then, but things where you would move the people around and fight things. And then also the sort of Infocom style text adventures and what have you. And I would get into that a lot. And then I would subsequently take those and I would kind of run those for people on the playground when I was growing up, not knowing that I was GMing. until such time as I figured out later how the rules of Dungeons and Dragons actually worked and figured out what I was doing. I got into that. Finally, in high school, started playing D&D and some other RPGs like Talos Lanta and Shadowrun and various things of that nature. Sidled into it in college as well. Played more of the usual, the D&D type stuff, traditional RPGs. Just after college, I started getting more into the White Wolf type games. I was meeting people who were more into vampire and werewolf and things of that nature. And so I started getting more into games where you had a different paradigm. And I'd actually had a friend of mine introduce me to Call of Cthulhu shortly before that. So I was already becoming used to the idea of maybe you're not just supposed to kill things and take their stuff. Maybe you can do other things in a game. Maybe. I know, right? Aren't they fountains of XP? You just have to find the right place to open them, and the XP's inside.
Yeah.
Everything you meet is an XP pinata. But I digress. basically, got into that, and then got through that into live-action gaming, which was its own brand of oddity, but focused a lot more on staying in character a lot of the time. Of course, which I always enjoyed because I'm an actor and I'm an incorrigible ham. as we will discover throughout the course of this interview, doubtless. It was later on, more time passed, as it does in that life thing that we enjoy doing.
Yeah.
And it was in the early aughts or mid-aughts when I started finding out more about podcasting. And I started... it was the funniest thing because I'd been playing D&D again for quite a while. I'd gotten into that and I had played some other games and other RPGs, so I was familiar with the ideas of other things. But the whole revolution with indie gaming and narrative control being assigned to the players and things like that was foreign to me up until I started listening to podcasts for role-playing games. Because I started listening to the D&D podcast because I wanted rumors about 4th edition.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, just choking to death for a moment there.
breathe.
Yeah, I have to remember to do that. It's then, right? Anyway, if we're all to follow the Darth Vader model. So I started listening to podcasts and heard about games like Fiasco and...
Okay.
Penny for My Thoughts and other such games, which are much more narrative. And then I started trying out those games, playing them, and I was addicted because I thought, my goodness, a way for lazy game masters to come up with things much more easily.
Right.
Which is something I had always been looking for. So got more into those. And I think it was like roughly around the same time I'd gotten into the sort of more White Wolf type games, I got more into the Savage Worlds type games as well. So I was into, I was familiar with the concept of in-game currency by that point, different bennies or points or what have you that you can spend on things. And okay. So basically, those were all the major touchstones, I think, for my development as a gamer. And then ultimately, Numenera happened, and here we are.
So how did you get into Numenera? I think you said you were part of the Kickstarter?
Yes, the...
Lucky dog.
Well, I know. Marty Cook was on the corner of Dragon Con selling them out of his coat, and I went up and... No. I went to see Marty Cook talk at Dragon Con, he talked about Numenera, his ongoing Kickstarter at that time, and I had heard of it, but I didn't know anything about it, so I thought, okay, well, as he's talking about it, let's hear what he has to say. And one of the first things that I heard him say was that he was inspired heavily by Gene Wolfe.
Mm, okay.
And the Book of the New Sun and such, where he, sort of the Dying Earth genre, essentially, for the creation of Numenera. And, of course, I immediately perked up because that's one of my favorite authors, so I was like, oh, okay, well, let's listen to that. Pay more attention. And I really loved the picture he painted of the setting. And of course, after he finished giving his talk, I went up and I geeked all over him, as one has a tendency to do, even though you try to stop yourself. You know, you see somebody like a celebrity or someone you appreciate, and you try not to go up and make a total jerk of yourself. And of course, I utterly failed to do that. pretty much halfway through, I realized what I was doing, and having stumble talked my way into it, I then attempted graciously to stumble talk my way out of it, and then left the room and was hopefully forgotten at that point. until we all hear it on this podcast,
right. Digging up the past.
Yep. yes, the delicious pain of the past, but. So I became more interested, and I thought, okay, I'm definitely pledging on this when I get home. And I got home, and then, of course, David and Eric came up to me, and they were like, hey, Numenera! And I'm like, okay. As it happens, I've heard a little bit more about this. And so it kind of got in from there. And the funny thing is, I have not really had much of a chance to play it. I've gotten a chance every now and then to play it. We did during the playtesting period for Numenera. I got to play some.
Okay.
And every now and then, someone at the table at our gaming group will run Numenera for us, sort of in like a sort of mini campaign type stuff. But I haven't had a chance to do it extensively as of yet.
Okay. Are you planning to play or run The Strange when it comes out? Or are you?
I hope so. I really like the concept for The Strange. I particularly like the idea of the different recursions that you can have, because I also, as I am a habitual world builder, so I can't stop myself. So that's something else that it will only feed that particular problem that I have. And so I'm actually eager to look into The Strange more and do more with it.
Awesome. Well, you mentioned Gene Wolfe, and I remember you talking about the new Sun series on the Transmissions podcast.
Yes.
And I thought it sounded really cool because I'd never heard of it. And I went and got the books, and I've finished the first one. I'm partway through the second one. Would you like to, I don't know, tell people a little bit more about those books and kind of what the story is?
Okay.
Or the setup, I guess.
Yeah, I can do that. I can do that. How spoilery do you want me to get on this?
I don't know. I guess that's up to you.
Okay. We'll figure it out as it goes.
Yeah.
I would say that now, first of all, I would say that reading Gene Wolfe, in particular, reading the Book of the New Sun, because, well, yeah, really, to be fair, it's more just the Book of the New Sun.
Okay.
It's kind of like the literary equivalent of drinking a Pangalactic Gargle Blaster. it is like having your brain smashed out by a slice of lemon wrapped around a large gold brick.
Awesome. I like it.
it kind of is. I was back once again in the 90s. Another game that I had discovered was the Amber Diceless RPG.
Okay.
Which was based on the works of Roger Zelazny. One of the players that I had in a game of that I ran was heavily into Gene Wolfe, and I had seen that Zelazny had also somewhat been influenced by Gene Wolfe, and so I started looking into the books that were recommended there. And okay. So I started with the Book of the New Sun. Now, the Book of the New Sun is actually it is a four-part series with five parts, in that there is a coda that is sort of a fifth part. And as I was reading it, it's one of those things where there is a mysterious thing going on. It's something like a million years in the future, or very far in the future at least, where the sun is dying. The human race is still there, but it's very much about control and control of your environment and control of other people. Okay. Actually, in very much a way that I want to say the world of Numenera is not. So while I think that the Book of the New Sun can be good for certain kinds of inspiration, one needs to also pay very close attention if you're, you know, looking for inspiration for Numenera to the way that world is set up. You know, how equality amongst people and all that works in the game material and not so much from something like the Book of the New Sun, because there's a lot of desperation that is not necessarily there in Numenera. I think Numenera is a much more positive environment. So okay. I wanted to make sure I made that distinction.
Okay. Yeah, and something I want to point out to people is Gene Wolfe uses a lot of, I guess you could say, archaic language.
Yes.
I mean, I literally have a dictionary app on my phone handy when I'm reading this book, because there are so many words I've never seen before. And they're real words. You know, you look them up and they're some word that was in vogue, you know, centuries ago.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing, is a lot of the words have not been used since the time of the Roman Empire. And so you have to be careful. And it's interesting what he's doing there, because it's... And he even says this in the appendix. It's a he's writing it in a language which has not yet achieved existence.
Right.
It is being sent back through time for us to witness. It is a first-person narrative by Severian, who is at the start of the story, an apprentice torturer, and he goes through a long series of journeys. And they're all it's all in first person, and it's all very, I think that it's the most consistent first person I think I've ever seen, because it's a thing where things that would not seem unusual to the narrator are not mentioned. And so there is a lot you kind of have to fill in gaps with your mind as you're reading it. And as you go through, more and more layers of mysteries fall back. And so what I had myself doing is it was painful in a way to read, because you had all of this archaic language and you had these concepts that you wanted to grasp, but you weren't quite sure, because he's not showing you the whole thing. Right. He's only showing you like 3/4 of it. And so my brain is like gnawing at it, trying desperately to get at the rest of it. And, so I was reading the thing faster and faster, even as the pain increased. Until I finally got to the end, I was like, oh my God, I understand everything now. Ah! And that lasted for a few days until my brain returned to normal. And then strangely enough, I found I was able to read anything after that for quite a while. I was able to read biographies at that point. I could read textbooks and I was okay. And so that was a strange side effect of that experience. So it is a thing that I do not necessarily recommend to everyone, but it is a thing that I think if you are willing to undergo the possible temporary amputation of your sanity to get through, it can be worth it.
Yeah, you have to be a very active reader. If you just want to sit there and passively absorb a story, you're going to have a hard time with this book, because you're not going to know what the hell's going on. You got to kind of have to sometimes look a word up or just kind of read things a few times and figure out exactly what's going on. And
yeah, I mean, some of it you can act. I think context. I think for the purpose of the context, you can actually get some by listening to the audiobook. That I think has helped some folks with it. But if you're just reading through it, you can either sit there with an unabridged dictionary and hope that it's got all the words in it.
Yeah.
Or you can just try to pick it up through context, which I did both. I alternated back and forth as I was going through. I think once they got to the word Smilodon, I was just like, okay, I'll just figure it out from this point on. This is taking me too long to read. I need to find out what happens. I will go ahead, I guess, and talk a little bit about what happens in the Book of the New Sun. Okay. So there may be a few spoilers from this point on.
Okay. You've been warned.
you have been warned. Turn back now. So, as I said, Severian is with the Torturers Guild. He essentially falls in love with one of his prisoners, who is a high-placed lady of the Autarch's court. The Autarch being the ruler of their sort of nation empire thing in their lands. I'm also going to be very vague because it's been a while since I've read some of it.
Sure.
But also because it's just easier to be vague about it. Because the details are maddening to a certain extent. So he helps her to kill herself because she cannot stand what she has been sentenced to at that point. The Autarch essentially has had her chained up because she has a connection to a rebel group, which is a very large rebel group, as it turns out. And for a very long time, they don't do anything to her, but then eventually they do start the tormenting process, and after the first session, she is almost completely broken, and he essentially smuggles a weapon in, and she does herself in. And so politically, they can't kill him for that, because there are a number of things going on at the time that would make it inconvenient for them to do so. Mm-hmm. Also, they don't really want to kill him because he's always been a very good student and such. They do like him. They do care about him. So they send him off to be a headsman in a territory far to the north called Thrax. And so the first two books largely encompass his journeys to Thrax. Okay. On his way, he meets up with a group of theatrical performers, and takes place in their various things. And the star of those two books, at least, and actually, I mean, the whole thing is really the setting, because what you have is, as you read this, you see the society that seems largely medieval in a lot of its mindset and a lot of its thoughts and a lot of its descriptions of things.
Mm-hmm.
But they have these advanced technologies that are completely normal to them because they've been around, you know, since time immemorial, to right. the point that a lot of folks have forgotten how a lot of these things work. But essentially, the long story short, in the course of this journey, he finds an object referred to as the Claw of the Conciliator, which is a holy relic that he believes allows him to heal the sick, which in some cases it does, in some cases it doesn't. And in some cases he finds actually bring people back from the dead.
Oh, wow.
Now, it is a crazy thing. Up until the point that he eventually is part of what he wants to do is return it to the holy order that he knows it belongs to. Now, one of the big things that is kind of a secret going on in the background here is that there is actually time travel going on.
Oh, really?
And there is, yes. And so some of the weird stuff that happens, there actually is a reason for, but we don't know what it is yet, because in a way, the stuff that's happened hasn't happened yet.
Oh, okay.
If that makes any sense at all.
Yeah.
What ultimately is going on is that Severian, eventually he makes it to Thrax, and then he... I'm trying to remember what happens there. There is, I think he lets somebody go. Yes. He lets somebody else go. There's someone he's supposed to detain and ultimately execute, and he lets them go. And so he leaves his post and he makes a run for it. And that happens in the third book, which I believe is Sword of the Lictor. And then in the fourth book, Citadel of the Autarch, he gets swept up into this war that's going on in the north and meets up with the Autarch, who he has actually met before. And now to get into the even deeper spoilers, and before I go on, do you want to hear this?
Actually, I probably don't, because I'm still reading it. I'm in the Claw of the Conciliator at this point,
okay.
I think.
Well, like well, then I will say more things happen.
Yeah,
and his brain bends further.
Cool. Well, I think you've given us like a good kind of the setup of the story and kind of what to expect and some of the cool things that happen.
Yeah. And then as far as the Earth of the New Sun, which is the coda, goes, take all of the transformational things that happen in the first four books and multiply it by about 20.
Oh, cool.
And basically, I will just say that Severian is more than he seems at first, and that continues to happen over and over again, where he becomes more and more and more than he seems to be. And that's all I'll say.
Very cool. Well, you mentioned it is from a first-person perspective, and usually first-person is not my favorite viewpoint. But one thing that's really cool about how the first person is done in this story is, Severian, the main character, has basically a photographic memory to like the extreme, which I thought is really cool because it explains how he's able to recount the story in such detail, you know, which is something that like you just kind of have to suspend disbelief on with a lot of first person narratives. It's like, well, how would the person really remember all this stuff in the story? But in this story, it makes sense because he has this crazy, like eidetic memory where he just like, he actually remembers to such a large degree that sometimes he kind of loses track of reality while he's caught up in these memories.
Yeah. And it's cool. It's funny. I was just listening the other day to a spot on I think it was Science Friday on NPR, where they were talking about how the memory works and that to a certain extent we really need to forget things because there are people who can't,
Right.
And it makes everything get jumbled because it's kind of like a split screen thing in their minds where they're seeing the past and the present kind of at the same time, and they have to concentrate to keep it all straight.
Yeah.
And so that's, yeah, that's definitely something that happens. Actually, in a lot of Gene Wolfe's works, he will try to come up with some sort of gimmick, essentially, for how the narrative is coming out.
Yeah.
And it's, he pays a lot of attention to that. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I just saw Dr. Michio Kaku on The Daily Show recently, and he was...
Yeah.
He just put out a book about the mind, and he was talking about the exact same thing, these people that do have this perfect memory, and how as they get older, it gets harder and harder for them to kind of be aware of what's going on around them because they just have so much going on in their heads.
Yeah, exactly. Or that's like me now.
Yeah. Well, another thing he does that is cool and is very, very similar to how things are done in Numenera is... I think in the appendix of the first book, he talks about how he will use common terms like a horse or something, but he points out that, well, it's not really a horse. You know, it's some creature that we don't have a word for. But it's like you said, he's like translating from this future language into our language. And so,
yeah, exactly. It's like, it's not exactly a horse, so I'm going to call it a destrier.
Right.
Because that is far away enough from our current present day consciousness that we're not exactly sure what it is. And so that I think is the best way I can describe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. No, it's very cool.
So for someone who wants to take the plunge and try out some Gene Wolfe, where would you recommend that they start?
Well, I think that I think that for most folks, actually the easiest point of entry for just Gene Wolfe in general, without necessarily worrying about whatever series it's involved in, I'd actually recommend going to the Wizard Knight series.
Okay.
Because you can, it's written from the perspective of someone who is from present day Earth.
Oh, cool.
So that's much easier in that respect. It's basically in that genre of someone goes to a fantastical land.
Okay.
It's a fantasy book. There are only two books in the series, the Knight and the Wizard.
Okay.
And it's essentially, this boy finds himself in another land, and it actually has a lot of imagery, a lot of things taken from a number of different mythologies that Western society, at least, is very familiar with. It takes a lot from the Arthurian sort of mythos. It takes a lot from the Norse mythology. It takes a lot from Christian mythology. And it sort of layers them together and puts it all into this very interesting sort of system of existence that I think fans of fantasy will like. It will be very interesting to them, and I think it's very accessible, kind of in that regard. Cool. If you want to get into the sort of edge your way into the stuff that we've been talking about, as far as the New Sun and such, the later books, the later series, the Book of the Long Sun, actually is not a bad starting point. It is more accessible. Because the people in that society are kind of closer to something that we can kind of get a hold of in our brains. It's a series taking place on, spoilers, a generation ship.
Oh, cool.
But society is still basically medieval, and it's really freaking huge. So it's a thing where there is a lot from sort of medieval society type setup, but there are also a lot of modern things. There are automatons walking around, and when you die, you go to a place called Mainframe, and so a lot of very interesting things happening there. And it's in the same universe as the New Sun books, so you have those, and then the Book of the Short Sun follows up on that. Actually, some of the same characters from the Book of the Long Sun. When you get into the Book of the Short Sun, actually, eventually, you also will start seeing things from the Book of the New Sun in there. Nice. So if by that point you're brave enough to have tackled Book of the New Sun, then you'll recognize some of the later references. Book of the Long Sun, Book of the Short Sun, much more accessible than Book of the New Sun, if you're just trying to dip your toe in the water.
Cool. Awesome. Well, I'm going to switch gears here a little bit. You have an adventure that you wrote that's on the Ninth World Hub called Towers of Glass, I believe. Which I have read and I really liked. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. Yeah, basically, I wanted to have an adventure to run at conventions. And this was very early in the... very early in essentially from as far as in our knowledge of Numenera, it was not long after it had come out.
Okay.
And I had not had the opportunity to read it yet. I had a very basic understanding of the rules because I played it a little bit. And so I wanted to come up with something that was I thought would work with Numenera, with that world, but wasn't necessarily tied to any specific location because I didn't know the locations.
Okay.
And so a lot of it actually, in my mind, I just sort of went back to what I knew of Gene Wolfe and was thinking, okay, there are certain feelings we'll try to get from that. And then I had recently seen a movie called The World's End.
Oh, yeah.
With Simon Pegg. Yes, you've seen
it. I love that movie.
Yes.
It was so much fun.
So there is, okay, again, spoilers. For anyone who, for those millions of you who may be looking at Towers of Glass, in other words, those like one or two of you, I loved the idea of I remember that scene. Remember that scene at the end of The World's End where, you know, he's talking with the alien life form who cannot comprehend why the human race should not want to be helped along.
Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of thing. I decided, okay, I took that. And I combined it in my mind with sort of the DC Animated Universe take on Brainiac, where he goes out collecting different worlds before they die, or the people of different worlds, sort of in a kind of a sort of matter to energy thing, or just as far as just the data of the world, the knowledge of the world. And I thought, okay, so what if there is some sort of extra dimensional entity going around and collecting different civilizations before they go away? And so I figured, okay, and so who gets to be the lucky ones that get collected, quote unquote lucky ones,
right?
yes, I know, right? And so they do it as a series of and so I figured, okay, it's a series of trials.
Okay.
And so I said, okay, so he's set up this place that kind of appears and disappears because it's going through multiple dimensions. That essentially was worked out. Maybe there's some sort of Numenera device that is found on Earth that lets him do this more efficiently. And that's where I came up with the idea for the Towers of Glass. And essentially, what happens in the adventure is there's this. This what looks like a city that appears in the distance and then disappears within about a day's time, and a trade baron's sister has gone missing and was last seen heading for that city, and so the PCs are hired to go and try to get into this city and see if they can find her, because they've just predicted when and where it's going to show up next, and Anno has kind of figured it out. And so you go out, and there are these three, what look like three towers made of colored glass, a red tower, a green tower, and a blue tower. And also, there seems to be a silver tower at the center, but once you actually get through the penetrating dome, it doesn't seem to be there anymore, because it's there on more than one level, and then eventually you meet up with someone who is kind of a projection inside, who communicates with the party about kind of what the place is and what its purpose is, and that it's all run by the archivist, and the only way to really get in to see the archivist is to complete one of the tests. And currently, we are testing three different species, one in each of these towers. If you want to go in, if they give you permission to participate in their trials, then you may, if you pass their trial by whatever means they've set up, then you can have their spot, that whatever that individual spot was going to be, and you can come into the archive. And so that's basically the idea, is that in each of the towers, you have a different civilization on a different distant world. that you are able to visit by stepping into the tower. I was always fascinated by the idea of technology that could let you be in two places at once. So while you're inside the tower, you're actually also on this distant world.
Very cool.
And so you go in and, it's like, it's basically a question. The three different, civilizations are very different from each other. And, so you go in and, for each one's more sort of an artificial intelligence organization, group, of automatons. And another is a sort of a four-armed warrior, culture. And then the third is an underwater culture that communicates largely telepathically. And, you can go in and you can try these different trials. And if each of the party members succeeds at a trial, then they can come out and they can see the Silver Tower and eventually be allowed into it. And the idea, of course, is that then that's when you meet the archivist, and he wants to archive you, and you have to kind of convince him not to. Yeah. Unless you want to be archived at that point, but pretty much it does mean you lose pieces of yourself if you if you're there. And, of course, the Trade Baron's sister was archived after she passed one of the trials, and it's the issue of going and getting her back and then trying to escape. And so that's the overall thing of that adventure.
Yeah, I thought it was such a great adventure and such a perfect kind of showcasing of what a Numenera adventure can be like, because it's like this juxtaposition of like the trials of Hercules from like a really out there Star Trek episode or something.
Yeah,
it's very. Cool.
I was trying to think episodically, kind of just in general, because when you do a convention game, you have to try to cram it into usually like 4 hours, possibly less.
Okay,
and so that's why there are three trials. Three towers basically, and that's why originally in my head I was thinking of four towers, and they thought no, just in case, because they've got the other thing too, so
yeah,
you want to try to space it out into a certain amount of time. And basically a lot of self-contained stuff, and Numenera actually lends itself to that, which is nice.
Cool.
You can get things done with just a few rolls.
Yeah
Sometimes even just a single roll, so that that was very helpful in that regard.
And your combats don't have to last hours.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very important, especially in the when they visit the warrior culture.
Yeah, yeah. So how does running an adventure at a convention, how is that different from just running a game for your friends?
Well, there is a time crunch. That's one of the biggest differences. You've got to make sure you're getting in and out in 4 hours, including introducing the characters, introducing people to the game and the concepts in the game and how the game works.
Okay.
You have to make sure that there is a beginning and a middle and an end that they will reach within that time period. And that a lot of people do have difficulty trying to put that kind of thing together. It is possible. You just have to kind of focus on basically giving them that package. Okay. When you do the convention, it's kind of really, you're just giving them, don't try to stuff everything in there is what I'd recommend. It's really just, you're giving them a taste of the thing.
Okay.
You're showing them, and your characters are kind of like ambassadors for the setting, because that's what they're going to focus on a lot, are the characters and what you build for them, and then what they get to do. And so it's really just, I'd say, yeah, you're painting in wider strokes.
Okay.
When you are doing a convention game. Whereas in a home game, you can stop halfway through, pick it up next week if you want.
Yeah.
Because your group will still be there, hopefully. There is more of an expectation of a continuing thing possibly in home games. So it's something you kind of, well, even if you just want to run it as a one shot, you have to keep in mind that a lot of the people, your regular group, if they're around the table, are going to be thinking of it in, possibly in terms of, it's like, okay, maybe I get to do this next time, even if there won't be a next time, because they're going to be physically there next time, right. Even though the game and the characters will be completely different.
So do you usually, pre-generate characters, or do people make characters as well?
For convention games, I always pre-generate characters unless making characters is part of the narrative of an individual session. Like, say, for example, if you're going and you're moderating a game like Fiasco, you make your characters at the table. That's part of the whole thing. You build the scenario and do it all in one go.
Right.
Kind of the same thing with a game like Don't Rest Your Head. You can do it that way. Or games like In a Wicked Age. In a Wicked Age is kind of famous for that. But most games that I run at conventions, I'm usually running, if I'm not running Numenera, I'm running Savage Worlds is actually the game that I tend to run more often than not.
Okay.
And I always try to have characters ready ahead of time for that.
Cool, cool. So I've never run a game at a convention before, and I've seen some questions on Google Plus lately from people that are thinking about running their first convention game. Do you have any tips or advice for someone about to run their first convention game?
Okay, don't panic. That's the first thing. If you are lucky, you will never see these people again, so don't so don't worry too much. I would say just be prepared as best you can. Don't over prepare because you easily can.
Okay.
For something like that, but make sure that you have the things ready that you know you will need to have and you know you will need to look at over the course of the game.
Okay.
It's really the time crunch is the big thing in convention games. So just make sure that you have something that can play out in the amount of time that you've been given. And it can be really difficult to figure out if that's going to be the case ahead of time. I like to run play tests of my convention games with one of my home groups before I go, and I do it at a convention if I have the chance. So it's always good to just sort of try it out ahead of time just to see how it's going to run.
Okay.
And you can address problems and such that will come up. And also, the great thing about convention games is you can use them over and over and improve them each time.
Yeah.
That's always an awesome thing you can do.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. So one thing that I really liked about your Towers of Glass adventure was I thought you did a great job of having weird elements in the adventure and the setting to kind of showcase the setting of the Ninth World. Do you have any advice for adding weird to your game? Do you have any tricks that you use?
It's kind of almost a nebulous concept, really. There are as many different types of weird as there are stars in the sky. I'd say the short version is look at a thing and turn left. That's all I can think of. It's hard to try to be unpredictable or do something that people will think of as odd. It's really easy to try too hard if you're doing that.
Yeah.
I would just say if you come across something that you find weird or just psychologically interesting that you think you'd like to explore, just try to isolate that and figure out what about that is strange or funny or terrifying or whatever it is you're trying to get across, and then build off of that concept. You know, just extract kind of the weirdness that you find, detach it from the thing itself, and then you can, and you know, make it into your own thing. It's kind of like I said, I totally got part of the Skies of Glass adventure from the World's End.
Yeah, yeah. You
know? But it's a different thing. It's a similar concept, but I sort of took the spin on the idea of just an entity that cannot comprehend the idea that people are going to want to remain human. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's all that's important to that life form was preserving things. And I guess that's another thing. It's if you're trying to create characters that are going to come off as weird to people, just try to figure out what is important to those characters.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the weird thing you're wanting to explore. And if you imagine that thing is important to those characters, and there's one thing missing that most normal people would find important.
Yeah, yeah.
But this person does not. This does not seem to be an obstacle to this person. That's always a good way to approach it, I think.
Cool. Yeah, something I've heard discussed on some like writing podcasts that I've listened to is they talk about something called the strange attractor, which is where you take something really mundane and normal, and then you take something really weird and you like smash them together.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know, like something normal, like a cow, you know, some kind of herd animal, but something weird, like, well, maybe these cows make some kind of telepathic field that makes everybody around them like feel really happy or something, you know?
Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah. So I think that works with Numenera, and it seems like Monty Cook Games, that's kind of what they do a lot of times, is that they'll take something that seems kind of familiar, but then they'll give it this really weird kind of twist to it.
Yeah, mashups are great, actually, for that. If you try to take an element of one thing and kind of figure out how it would work if it were applied to another, that always comes out, I think, pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. And I think they even said something in the core book along the lines of, you know, don't just take, you know, two things and smash them together, but take a whole bunch of different things. And
yeah. Yeah. Of course, what I say always comes out pretty well. I don't mean that it always comes out pretty well. I mean that it always comes out pretty well. No, it's, as we say, the same thing over and over in just different inflections, and that totally changes it. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, obviously not everything is going to work, but it's something that I think an approach that more often than not is helpful if you're trying to build kind of odd, interesting, unique things.
Yeah. Yeah, it does seem like Numenera makes the GM's job a lot easier in a lot of ways. But two things that I find really challenging about running the game is you know, getting that weird element in as much as possible, and just coming up with good GM intrusions that are happening often enough and are interesting.
Oh, yeah. I swear, it's... coming up with GM intrusions has also been something that I keep trying to do, and that like I said, all I've really run thus far in Numenera is the Towers of Glass scenario, and I get more intrusions out of the equipment that they're carrying than anything else. Pretty much, because I will say, actually, I kind of lied a little bit when you said, do you generate the characters entirely ahead of time? I actually, one thing that I have found that I do with the groups when I'm running at least this scenario is that I always have them roll for their oddities.
Oh, cool.
Because that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to see what they'll do. And the awesome thing is, in both the playtest and in the actual game that we had, they got the frictionless pants. Someone got the you know, the it's that oddity where it's like a pair of pants, and it's very it's like slightly cool to the touch, but it's got like some sort of weird magnetic field thing going where it never gets dirty.
Right.
And so I always can throw in that GM intrusion where it's like they're trying to get through this barrier to get into the city, and there's a slight interruption, and they're like, you think your pants are holding you back slightly. You have to try to push through harder. And I was able to turn that into a GM intrusion.
That's awesome. I think those pants would go great in the Last Glimmer, the Love and Sex in the Ninth World. It'd fit right in.
Yes, I think so as well. Yes. It's, they have a multitude of uses.
Oh, yeah.
But no, and actually, I'm very grateful that the Sex and Love Glimmer came out, because it is the kind of thing that the advice that's given in there, you cannot hear enough.
Right.
I would actually, in fact, I would caution anyone who is, to tie into earlier things, anyone who is looking to the Book of the New Sun for inspiration should also read the Sex and Love in the Ninth World Glimmer.
Yeah.
Because gender relationships in the world that Gene Wolfe has established are not great. And there is an argument that actually he does that deliberately to kind of point out the sort of the horrors of society in a way, and the way that things could go, as kind of a warning.
Yeah.
But it's whether that's the case or not, you don't want. You've got a much better example in Sex and Love in the Ninth World.
Yeah.
As a way of looking at how to do relations. So I definitely lean in that direction if you're trying to set up a game.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. So, Jim, I know that you are on a number of podcasts. Would you like to tell the listeners what podcasts they can find you on?
Yes. Hello, my name is Jim, and I'm an inveterate podcaster.
Yes. Are you on the 12-step program yet, or are you holding off on that?
I've been working on it. I keep falling off the wagon. But yes, I will. To save time, I will not talk about my old stuff.
Okay.
But yes, of course, I am on Transmissions from the Ninth World, which you can find at transmissionsninthworld.blogspot.com.
Okay.
I am also one of the hosts of the Crucible of Realms podcast, which you can find at crucibleofrealms.com. And that is a podcast which is both a gaming podcast and a writer's podcast. Cool. Whereby we have different guests on, and every episode we build a world. It's a lot of fun. It's just a total brainstorming thing. And we've built worlds with many a folk. We've had game designers on. We've had science fiction and fantasy writers on, and it's always a blast. It's always a lot of fun to do, especially for someone like myself who is addicted to world building. So there is that, and also I have my own podcast, which is sort of more of a bit of pod bloggery or a blogcast, depending on. Where you want to put the first and second bit of that word. And that is at jimyesthatjim.com.
And, great.
And that's my personal page. Pretty much you can find links to all of my various things that I'm doing there and the various writing that I'm doing and the books that I'm in and stuff like that that I'm always trying to work toward, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it sounds like you stay very busy.
Oh, yes.
You're not just laying around being fed grapes and getting fat.
No. Oh, that'd be so wonderful. But sadly, no. No, my brain will not shut up. And so as a result, I must do what the voices say or they will torture me.
That's right. And you're on Twitter, too, as well, right?
Yes. I am at OtherDoc, OtherDoc. If you wish to check me out on Twitter, I try to tweet at least once a day if I can, and then sometimes more frequently if I've got stuff happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, Jim. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoy your podcast. I love the sound quality. I think it's excellent. And I really like what you do on it. So I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I'm mostly self-taught, so I guess I got lucky somehow.
you got it right.
Well, awesome, Jim. Hopefully I can have you on again in the future.
Sure. I am an incorrigible ham, so I will take any and every opportunity to be loud on the internet.
Awesome. Well, I will definitely keep that in mind.
GM Intrusions Wrap Up.
All right, time to wrap up episode 20. If you would like to reach me, you can email me at lexstarwalker@gmail.com. Please follow me on Twitter at lexstarwalker. I try to tweet on a regular basis about the show and let you know when the next episode's coming out and when I'm recording and who I'm interviewing this week. If you have something that you'd like to say about Numenera or The Strange and you're interested in being a guest on the show, please let me know. I'm always looking for guests for the show. And I want to thank Jim again for the great interview today. And you can follow him on Twitter at OtherDoc, OtherDoc. And I'll have links to his blog and podcasts on the show notes. You can check those out. And you can check those out at starwalkerstudios.com/GM Intrusions. I would like to send a big thank you to David, Andreas, and Dan for supporting the show by becoming patrons. Really appreciate it, guys. Super cool of you, and I really appreciate all of my patrons. I thank you so much, and I just want to thank everyone who's become a patron and everyone who's helped me get the word out about my Patreon page. I do have a video on the page. It's pretty terrible. My first shot at video, I'm definitely not a movie star. So if you want to see that, you can check out the Patreon page at patreon.com/GMIntrusions. And that's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And finally, please, please enter the GM Intrusions Listener Appreciation Contest. It's still going on, still going strong. All you have to do to enter is go to the website, starwalkerstudios.com, go to episode 18 of GM Intrusions entitled Love and Sex in the Ninth World, and leave a comment under episode 18. And in that comment, give me a GM Intrusion, and that will be your entry in the contest. Please, just one entry per person, although you can, of course, leave as many GM intrusions in that comment as you want. It'll just help me tally things up when it comes time to select a winner. That will be done randomly. I'm not going to try and judge the intrusions and pick the quote-unquote best one. So I will just randomly draw three winners. Each winner will receive a $25 discount code for the Monty Cook Games store, where you can get any print product. So any book, Numenera book, or I guess if you wait for a while, maybe you could get a Strange book. It does not, my understanding is it does not include the Glimmers, because those are PDFs, they're digital products, not print products. You can, get the Bestiary, or get, Arthur's Guide, to Numenera, or we can't remember the exact title of that, when it comes out, or the World Guide when it comes out. Lots of great stuff on the Monty Cook Game Store that you can use your prize for. So please enter the contest. And my intention, what I'm planning to do once this is over, I'm going to take all the GM intrusions submitted to the contest, all the GM intrusions that have been submitted for the show, and all the other intrusions that I've done on the show, and I'm going to put them all on the website so that you guys can go there and check them out and get some good intrusions for your game. And my hope is to keep this going and keep adding to it as I do the show and I get more and more intrusions. And, you know, maybe one day even make some kind of like searchable database. Like, maybe I shouldn't say this because then people will expect me to do it. But I really would love to do that so that someday when we have enough of them, that you go in and say, oh, I need an intrusion for this situation or whatever, and make it searchable, and you can go through all these intrusions. I think that would be really cool. But for now, we'll just have them listed on the site, and you can go through them, and maybe I'll try to categorize them in some way to make it easier to find one that's relevant to what you need. I decided today, instead of trying to come up with yet another intrusion for the intrusion of the week to end the episode with, I thought that I would use one of the many excellent GM intrusions that have been submitted for the contest. And speaking of the contest, one last thing I forgot to mention. When you leave a comment, make sure that whatever, whether you're signing in using your Google account or however you're leaving your comment on the site, just make sure that I have the correct address, email address, so that if you win, I can get a hold of you and get your prize to you. What some people have been doing, if it's not the email address associated with whatever account you're using to comment, just maybe put your email address in with the comment. I just picked one of the intrusions. I'm not going to say that this is my favorite, because they've all been really good. And that's another thing. I'm going to be using these on the show as well. So if you submit an intrusion for the contest, you will most likely someday hear it on the show. And I will, of course, credit you, because that's the right thing to do. So anyway, I just this is one of the more recent ones that have come in, and I really liked it, and it was just happened to be at the top of the page when I went to look. So I picked this one. This intrusion comes to us courtesy of Mr. Mark Massengale. I hope I'm saying that right. So thank you, Mark, for entering the contest, and thank you for submitting an intrusion. So this is an intrusion that you can use when a character is using an esoteric. The sudden pulse in the back of your head as you use the esoteric is unnerving at first, interrupting your action. A moment later, you feel an odd warmth between your ears. Then there is a piercing pain between your ears, followed by a gut-wrenching pop sound. The shocked look on everyone else's face tells you that you did not imagine it, and the hot warmth running down your chin confirms that you are bleeding from the ears. You take one might damage and do not take your current action. You may select a new action, but for this turn and the next, you may not use any esoteries. It's your action. Thank you for listening. I'm Lex Starwalker, and this has been a GM Intrusion.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality science fiction and fantasy podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Ish, Cloudwalker, Renfield, and Transboy. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com.
I'm awesome!